Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. Located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square Mall, downtown Urbana. Information is available at 384-2444.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, presenting Benjamin Britten's mini-opera, Noah's Flood, on Saturday, November 6th at University Place Christian Church in Champaign. The large cast includes singers and instrumentalists from throughout the community, with the Central Illinois Children's Chorus, the East Central Illinois Youth Orchestra, and Roger Cooper as the voice of God. For more information, call 355-9077 or visit prairieensemble.org.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. This morning we'll be talking in this part of the show a little bit about Latinos, about their attitudes and their political participation. This is kind of a companion to a program that we did yesterday where we asked some similar kind of questions about Asian Americans. We wanted to spend a couple of hours taking a look at these two major groups of Americans to talk about just how involved they are, how engaged they are in politics, and how important their participation is to American politics. And our guest for this hour of the show is Adam Siegel. He is director of the Hispanic Voter Project, which is based at Johns Hopkins University. This is an effort to try to get an idea of just the kind of things that we're talking about here. Political participation, attitudes, the issues that are particularly important to Latinos, and just what sort of a force they are now and will continue to be in American politics. That's what we'll be doing here in the first part of the show. Questions, of course, are welcome if you would like to call in. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air, of course, you can use the toll-free. And if you might happen to be listening on the internet as well, you can use that as long as you're in the United States. That number is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also, again, have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And at any point here, you want to join the conversation, you certainly should feel welcome to do that. Mr. Siegel, hello.
How are you? Good morning.
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks very much for talking with us. Maybe you want to just say take a moment and talk a little bit about the Hispanic Voter Project and what it's all about?
Sure. The Hispanic Voter Project at Johns Hopkins University is a research project that was founded in 2002, though research began really in earnest in 2000. And we focus on the ways that candidates, parties, and interest groups reach out to and communicate with Hispanic voters. And not only do we research and report on those efforts, but we're also very proactive and encourage the campaigns to make Hispanic outreach a higher priority than it has been in the past. And we encourage the campaigns, especially at the presidential level, but of course all campaigns, political campaigns, to make Hispanic staff members, Hispanic advertising specialists, and policy folks a higher part of the campaign structure. And we really do that because the more that Hispanics are involved with the inner workings of a campaign, the better that that campaign can reflect the needs of the community and better understand how to communicate with this growing voting population.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that is very obvious is that it seems that both parties and both campaigns think that this time around that Latinos are going to be very important to the outcome, at least if you look at the amount of money that they're spending trying to reach out to Latinos. That seems to be obvious. From some of the numbers that I've seen, the together, apparently, the Bush and Kerry campaigns have spent – this time around, $13 million on Spanish language media. And back in 2000, the two campaigns only spent $4 million. So obviously, that increase in spending says that they think that Latinos are important and they're trying to get their message out to them. Do you think that they will turn out to, Latinos will turn out to be a big factor in this election?
Well, I think, first of all, that you're right on. We have been analyzing the efforts this year, and we're finding record spending on Spanish language political advertising aimed at Hispanic voters, particularly in a handful of key battleground states. And in 4 out of the 10 most targeted battleground states, the ones that are up for grabs literally right now, a few days before the election, Hispanic voters in 4 of those 10 have a real opportunity to influence the entire outcome of that of the race in that state. And those are Florida, New Mexico, Nevada, and Colorado. And I think there are lots of other battleground states where, if it comes down to a few hundred or a few thousand votes, Hispanic voters can make the difference. And, you know, one example of one place like that would be Ohio, and another one would be Pennsylvania, which both have rapidly growing Hispanic populations, but that aren't anywhere near the 15, 20, or even 40% of the population in a number of the other battleground states. And I'm convinced that record numbers of Hispanic voters will turn out this year. And two things give me that impression. One is that each election cycle over the last 20 years, we've seen a rapid increase of Hispanic voters that have participated. And this year, we have seen a truly historic effort to register new Hispanic voters. And even since 2000, there has been a dramatic increase in the number of Hispanic Americans who are registered to vote.
Then I guess that was indeed one of the things that I was interested in hearing about, and whether you have some numbers. If you take a look at, say, first of all, how many Latinos there are, how many of them are eligible to vote, because obviously citizenship is an issue, and then of the people who are eligible, how many of those are registered, and indeed, I guess I'm wondering how, when you look at numbers of registered voters, whether what we see if you compare what's happening today with what things were looking like in 2000.
Well, across the country, there are more than 14 million Latinos or Hispanic Americans. And this year, interestingly enough, Hispanic Americans came to comprise the largest minority population in this country. For the first time, more Hispanics than African Americans in this country. So of the more than 14 million adult U.S. citizens that are Hispanic, about 8 million, maybe even 9 million, are registered to vote, perhaps more. And the actual voters, well, we look back to 2000, and 6 million Hispanics voted in that election. And I think every indication from even the most conservative sources, you know, those least likely to jump ahead or try to seek try to exploit the growth of this community, suggests that as much as 7, maybe even 8 million Hispanic voters could turn out to the polls this year.
Hmm. Well, that's still, well, when you take a look at turnout of registered voters. So if, and again, we're looking back what happened last time, if you're saying that there are 8 million, possibly as many as 9 million registered and 6 million voted, well, that's a pretty good turnout rate. Then you'd still have to look at the issue of if there are 14 million adult U.S. citizens who are Latino and 8 million, 9 million at the outside are registered, then maybe also you want to ask, well, why are those other people not registered?
Why are they not registered? Yeah. I think that I really believe that that there's a lag time that's really unique to the Hispanic community, and I think it begins where there's a lag time between when new immigrants become citizens and when new citizens eventually register to vote. You know, not every new citizen registers to vote the day that they become a new citizen. And so there's lag time there. And then there's further lag time between when a new voter becomes a long-term committed voter. And I think that that's part of the, you know, I think that's part of the immigrant experience in this country. And it's also part of a population that still has not fully come to recognize just how important every single Hispanic vote can make across the country. Hmm. I think certainly the 2000 election helped. There was a recognition that had the Gore campaign paid more attention to Hispanics in, let's say, Miami, Florida, where they spent zero on Spanish language TV ads and were blown away by the Bush campaign, which spent hundreds of thousands of dollars there, that certainly even a modest effort there could have helped them attract the 538 votes that would have given them a one vote advantage. And so I think that the reality is that an education and get out the vote effort has to be combined with a voter registration effort. Potential voters need to be educated about how their vote can have an impact and how the vote how the votes of their community has had an impact.
Let me again just very quickly reintroduce the guest for this hour. We're talking with Adam Siegel. He is director of the Hispanic Voter Project, based at Johns Hopkins University at the university's Washington Center for the Study of American Government in Washington, D.C. The goal of the project to draw attention to the growing political importance of the nation's Hispanic American voters and also to look at efforts being made by political parties and candidates and interest groups to reach these voters. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about how it is that when you go out and you try to sample Latinos and you ask them questions about, first of all, about their inclination to identify with one of the other political parties.
Yeah.
What it is that you find.
Well, there have been a number of broad national polls of Hispanic Americans this year. It's been a wonderful year for those efforts. And we're finding across the board that Hispanics are registered with a Democratic advantage of about 2-1. But there is a significant number of Hispanics that are that consider themselves to be independents, and that number is growing. And what that tells us is that Hispanic voters are increasingly up for grabs as more and more become, less affiliated or less biased by a connection to a party. It presents an opportunity, especially for the Republicans, who really, for many years, had not considered Hispanic voters part of their effort to expand the base of the party.
It seemed that for a long time among Hispanics, the most reliable supporters of the Republican Party, the people who are most likely to say, when you ask them, are you Democrat, Republican, or Independent, the ones that are the most likely to say they're Republicans have been Cuban Americans.
And clearly,
their attitudes are very, very clearly influenced by their feelings about American policy on Cuba.
Right.
And I think that continues to be the case, but I also have this feeling that may in some small way be changing, and that has something to do with perhaps generational change as we have greater numbers of Cuban Americans who were born in the United States who perhaps may have some differences in their attitudes on that issue, particularly differences between them and, say, their parents or their grandparents. Is the general sort of Cuban American identification as Republicans, support for Republicans, particularly for a really kind of a tough policy in regards to Cuba, has that stayed fairly constant, or are there any ways in which that might be changing somewhat?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that is the focus of a lot of articles in national newspapers this week and probably will be up through Election Day and afterwards. And that is trying to discern if there is any significant shift within the Cuban American voting population that could favor the Democrats. And the reality is that we already know of one huge example of what can happen when a Democratic candidate can run an aggressive campaign aimed at courting Cuban American voters and using either a record or a policy proposal that would be tough on tough on Castro and tough on foreign policy dealing with Cuba. And that was Bill Clinton's reelection campaign in 1996. And we know for certain that Clinton received thousands of votes that had previously gone in 1992 to former President Bush, but he was able to convert those voters to the Democratic Party line, largely on a strong domestic policy, but also because he was able to blur the differences between he and Senator Bob Dole during that election on Cuba policy. And it was really unfortunate for the Democrats that in the 2000 campaign that Vice President Gore was so much aligned with the Elian Gonzalez affair and the Clinton administration's handling of that effort, and also was hurt significantly by the aggressive courting of the Cuban community by the Bush campaign and a very tough line on Cuba. But we're finding right now that the Democrats are again now, I guess, 8 years later, willing to engage this community in a way that it never has done before. Groups like the New Democrat Network are airing Spanish-language and English-language TV and radio and print ads aimed directly at Cuban voters, even mentioning Castro and mentioning Bush's policies in their advertisements. And the Kerry campaign has also been very aggressive, airing Spanish-language radio ads on popular Cuban radio programs or during popular Cuban radio programs that include direct critiques of the Bush administration's Cuba policy, and that even go so far as to suggest that the Kerry administration will be tougher on Cuba than the Bush administration. And I think that that's a fascinating strategy, and I can't wait to see what the results are. I really believe that it's an uphill battle for Democrats to try to capture a significant percentage of the Cuban-American vote. I think that that will take a long time if they will ever achieve that. But this year, it's possible that the Democrats can peel away a few hundred or a few thousand votes, maybe 1 or 2 or 3% of the Cuban vote. And that could make all the difference in a very tight election where the outcome of the statewide results in Florida come down to only a few hundred or a few thousand votes, mm-hmm. as they did in 2000. And so comparatively, if you compare a few hundred votes to the strong support that Bush has received in the past, doesn't appear to be such a big deal. But in a hyper intensive election, hyper close election, it could make all the difference, and it could be worth every penny. Yeah. For the Democrats.
Well, and I guess, though, it's still in what I have read about just about the state of Florida, there. If you poll Hispanics and ask them, are you going to vote for Kerry, are you going to vote for Bush? Overall, Bush still gets more Hispanic votes, but that that does seem to be explained mostly by support of Cuban Americans. Because if also I think if you look at, for example, I think in 2000, Hispanic voters in Central Florida actually supported Gore, although they also supported Jeb Bush. And I guess that again has strategists looking at that and saying, well, here's a group of people who could basically go one way or another. But going back to the original point, it does seem to be that Florida Hispanics generally seem to be Republicans and seem to be supporting the president. But a lot of that does have to do, in fact, with Cuban Americans, and it's not the case. If you look other places where you don't have that kind of breakdown according to country of origin.
I definitely agree with that. And I think that a lot of, you know, with the demographic shift that's happening across the country with the growth of the Hispanic community, it's a question not only for politicians but for marketers trying to understand, you know, marketers and advertisers who are trying to understand exactly what makes the average Hispanic American tick, you know? Mm-hmm. What makes them vote a certain way? What makes them purchase a certain product? And because so much money is invested in these efforts, a lot of money is also invested in the research behind it. And I think that in the coming years, we'll find a lot of sociological research that digs deep into the demographics of the Hispanic community, the rapidly changing Hispanic community in Florida. And I think we'll come to realize that that this is a population that is changing and extremely diverse and is non-monolithic.
Yeah. Well, overall, I think that, the point should be made. I think it's in other times when I've been talking with people on this program about Latino and their political participation. And also we talked a little bit about this yesterday with yesterday's guest, where we're talking about sort of doing a similar kind of program, talking about Asian Americans, is that you have to be really careful about seeing these large blocks of people as large blocks, as monolithic, because it is the case that, and it seems to be something that a way in which perhaps the immigrant experience is changing somewhat in the United States, is that people still maintain a very strong identification with their country of origin. They're very, very interested in American politics, but they're also still in touch with the politics of the place from which they came. And now, the world being as it is, it's easier to maintain contact. It's easier to go back and forth, and that people still have this very strong sense that, for example, when we're talking about Latinos that or Hispanic, whatever kind of word you want to use, that people have maybe less tendency to identify themselves that way with that kind of global term as they do to say, I am a Mexican-American, I'm a Cuban-American, I'm a Puerto Rican-American, I'm a, you know, whatever, to really make a point of saying this is what I am and this is where I came from, so I am still in a sense sort of both of this. I am an American, but I have this strong tie yet to the place from where I come. And that can also make a difference in people's attitudes about things and how they think. And as we have discussed, it can even have an impact on how it is you identify politically.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that part of the intense focus on groups comes out of the, you know, a cultural tendency to try to be able to characterize people and characterize them in a way that we can understand them without having to dig too deeply or without having to know too many people, without having to read too much. So in a sense, it is overly simplistic to use terms like Hispanic and Latino unless we're being very specific about exactly what that term encompasses. And there are even debates over whether Hispanics in certain regions or certain cities prefer the term Hispanic over Latino or disregard both and prefer, like you said, to say that I'm a Mexican-American or a Puerto Rican-American or a Guatemalan-American. And it's an interesting thing to see. But nevertheless, in immigrant communities, even where Hispanic immigrants tend to reside in neighborhoods that might reflect their home country, you'll find that a huge Hispanic festival that happens in that community draws from the entire Hispanic community. And it draws because there are lots of things like language, music, culture, food that sort of cross boundaries, that cross national boundaries, at least in terms of national background or national identity that's based in Latin America. And one that in America can not as much melt these communities together, but allow immigrants to find some shared identity as a way of being more successful in this country.
Mm-hmm. When you just, out of curiosity, if you take a look at the breakdown of people according to their place of origin, what are the leading place, if you look by numbers, how does that break down?
Well, by far the largest population in the U.S. is Mexican American, and almost the entire Southwest, even from California, through Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, the communities there are almost entirely Mexican American. But in other parts of the country, like Florida and New York, you'll see a much more diverse population. Oftentimes, when we talk about Hispanics, we even leave out the millions of Puerto Rican Americans whose family origins put them in Puerto Rico, which of course is part of the United States, and part of the reason why in terms of how demographers work, why they're often left out of that accounting. I don't have the exact numbers for you in terms of the breakdowns of other communities. I could pull it up in a second.
Well, I don't know how important that is in the greater scheme of things, but I guess that was one thing I was just a little bit curious about. It certainly to look at the top three or four maybe would be according to where it is that they came from.
Well, and I think it makes sense, and there are lots of reasons. For instance, if you're using a performing artist who is going to perform at an event for Hispanic voters in a certain city, and you don't do enough research, it's possible that you could bring in a performing artist who is entirely unknown in one segment or one group of Hispanic Americans, but can be well known in others. One of the most popular performing artists in the country, her name is Paulina Rubio. She's a Mexican, performing artist, Part of her rise has been her ability to cross over not only into mainstream America, but also to cross over into popular culture within other Hispanic communities. But there are others who haven't been successful at doing that. And even politicians, if you're having a bus tour and you bring the mayor of Hialeah, Florida, on this bus tour. He happens to be a Cuban American Democrat, but will his message resonate with another community, with let's say a Puerto Rican community or another community, a Mexican American community? And that's it really depends on the individual. It depends on the situation. Another good one is the governor of New Mexico. One of his parents is a Mexican American, and so it would seem to be a natural that he would appeal as a Hispanic governor. Let's say he wanted to run for president, that he could appeal to Mexican Americans. But is he as popular? Or would the appeal be the same to other Hispanics who might have a different experience?
Well, we're a little bit past our midpoint here. I have a caller, and other people who are listening certainly are welcome to call with questions. And let me again introduce our guest. We're talking with Adam Siegel. He is director of the Hispanic Voter Project at Johns Hopkins University. It's based at the university's Washington Center for the Study of American Government in Washington, D.C., and they're particularly interested in drawing attention to the growing political importance of the nation's Hispanic American voters, and also to look at efforts by the political parties and by individual candidates and by interest groups to reach out to these voters. And we're talking a little bit about attitudes, political participation by Hispanic Americans. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, someone calling from Savoy nearby, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, hi. I just, wanted to make a comment that the breakdown of ethnic groups into, I don't know if you call them sub-ethnic groups or not, is extremely important. I think one of the problems that has happened, this sounds a little strange, is if you go anywhere in this country and you go into a Hispanic restaurant or a Mexican restaurant, it's been homogenized. And it's very hard, particularly here, where we have a very big Hispanic community, to be able to distinguish between different types of Hispanics. Americans tend to think, well, they're all the same because they all eat the same food, when in fact they don't. But it's sort of what they always said about Chinese food was basically never Chinese food in this country, but was an American version and went all the way across the country. And then I just wanted to make one brief comment. I'm a fifth-generation American, and sometimes people will ask me, are you Jewish? And I'll say, no, I'm a New York Jew. So we have really very precise distinctions between different groups based upon their geography as well as their background, and I just wanted to mention that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. I don't know, Mr. Siegel, you want to comment on that at all?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating point, and I think it just underscores this idea that the American immigrant experience, as different as it appears, can be very similar if you really try to break things down and understand the progress that communities make. I don't entirely agree that there's a full melding of Hispanic or Latin American communities in the United States, but I think that comes from my perspective of having been to Florida and New York and other places with thriving communities that have seen different immigration patterns, that have seen communities set up and succeed on their own. And so while it's true that there are Mexican restaurants that are perceived to be Mexican in certain parts of the country that really are really a melding of Latin American cuisine, there are lots of ethnic restaurants in ethnic neighborhoods that maintain a very strong very strong origin or identity. And I think that can also be a good thing.
All right, let's talk with caller in Champaign next, line number two.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I guess I have a one comment and one question. My comment would be just to feed off of what your guest just said, that it is really dangerous, I think, to think of the Latino community as one homogenous, monolithic population. For instance, in Florida, my understanding is that Cuban Americans are not the majority Latino group down there, but they do vote they are the majority that votes. They are sort of disproportionately represented within the electoral process. But if you really sort of start to look at the makeup of Latinos down there, it's much more complex and complicated. My comment, I guess, has to do with the issue of Latinos increasingly registering as independents, and I guess I'm wondering to what extent does that signal that Latinos are more driven by sort of issue-oriented politics as opposed to party politics? And I'm thinking primarily of, especially of newly registered Latinos who might be more motivated to vote regarding issues of immigration and border politics and things like that.
Well, Mr. Siegel?
It's a wonderful question, and it's almost so complicated that it becomes frustrating when pundits on, for instance, CNN, 5 minutes after an election, are quick to explain exactly how the Hispanic community voted and exactly what issue it was that made that ultimate shift. At the same time, I think that Hispanic Americans, from all the polling that I've seen this year, are very much ranking the same issues that, you know, among their top priorities as all other Americans. And so jobs and the economy and healthcare and education are tops. Immigration remains a very important issue, one that really cuts across you know, all Hispanic communities, and often can help influence how you know, individual Hispanic voters will vote. But it's the overarching issues, and that demonstrates that this is a community of Americans and not just not just immigrants, but people who have become either assimilated or acculturated, are very much tapped into the you know, into our society and into our economy, and contributing greatly, and also hoping to see their goals and aspirations achieved just as much as the average American.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, I'm glad that the caller raised this issue of particular issues that are of concern, because it's one of the things that I really wanted to talk about. And that, as you say, when you go out and you do surveys, as have been done, you find out that, you know, perhaps there's not as much difference between Latino Americans and others as you might think. For example, I have been looking here at the a survey that was done by the Pew Hispanic Center and the Kaiser Family Foundation. It's the 2004 National Survey of Latinos, Politics, and Civic Participation. And it's on the web if people want to look at it. It's fairly long and presents a lot of statistical information. One of the things that they did was they asked people, well, what issues concern you most? And I think that it's interesting that I would expect a lot of people to think that immigration would be a top issue. And while it is, it ranks behind education, the economy, health care, the war on terror, the war in Iraq, crime, social security, moral values, taxes, and the federal budget deficit. It comes next. Now that's not to say that people don't think that's important.
Right.
But all of these other things are ranked ahead, and not surprising, because it's the same concerns that I think a lot of Americans have. They're concerned about education, and they're concerned about the economy and jobs, and they're concerned about health care and Medicare, and they're concerned about national security and the war on terror. And those things are the top issues. And while immigration's there, these other things lead.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it will be interesting to see if there's a discernible fissure or breaking apart of Hispanic, Hispanic political identity or focus on the issues. You know, whether it's possible to find that newer or older generations of Hispanics have a different outlook, because as you know, right now Hispanic Americans are the largest minority in this country. Lots of citizens that are invested in the society and assimilated, and I think a lot of their political identity will be shaped in part by the communities that they're in, and also by the same issues that are facing all Americans. Well, what happens as there continues to be an influx of new immigrants who become new citizens? And will we really see two distinct voting groups within one Hispanic population? And I think that'll be fascinating. You know, one problem that we've already seen this year is that the candidates are largely focusing on Spanish language political advertising, but are doing very little to reach Hispanics who are English dominant but have very strong cultural identities and strong connections to the community. They're doing very, very little to reach them in a specific way. And I think that's one lesson that Hispanics can learn from other marketers who are actually jumping into this category of trying to reach English dominant Hispanics. And there are some new TV stations and TV cable companies that are getting into this business, a new station called CTV, SITV, that's based in Los Angeles, and it'll be interesting to see how well that does and how many viewers it attracts.
I guess I really am interested by the question that you touch on, where you say maybe there it really is no answer at this time. That is, what happens to generally to attitudes within a group that we're talking about across time as they become more, and I sort of hesitate to use the word assimilated because I know a lot of people maybe are not real happy with that word. But, you know, when you take a look at newcomers to the country, people who are not born in the United States but come here and become citizens, and then as they have children who are born in the United States, and you look at what happens to attitudes across the generations, what happens, and do you find that people's the children of immigrants who are born in the United States to parents who were not born in the United States, you know, are they really that different in their political attitudes, and does that over time does that spread increase? And I guess it sounds as if you're saying that indeed that's an interesting question, but it's you don't really have an answer for it.
Ed, I don't have a full answer, but to jump off this one point that you made, you were very cautious about using the term assimilation. Well, I'm someone who teaches marketing and advertising at Johns Hopkins University in the master's program, and it's a topic that I discuss in my ethnic marketing course, and I discuss it because assimilation and acculturation are two different terms and two different things. There are, of course, immigrant communities that become fully assimilated, so much so that their entire cultural identity is very much based on who they are as Americans, and much less on who they are as the children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren of immigrants. But there are others, and we're seeing this in the Hispanic community, that maintain a very, very strong cultural identity. Maybe will live in communities or neighborhoods where the population is dominated by their own communities, by Hispanics or Asian Americans or African Americans. And maintain a very strong cultural identity, but at the same time are also letting their culture and their individuality be influenced by American culture, American society, and their, you know, profession and education, and I think that those are two distinct things, and I don't think it's wrong to talk about either one of them, and it's a topic that's discussed with great intensity within immigrant communities. There are those who are advocates of multiculturalism and of course, often more strongly, bilingualism. And there are others, even new immigrants who have a very little grasp of English, who are opposed to bilingualism because they believe that Americans, that an immigrant to this country must learn English and must be fluent in English in order to succeed. And so if those are issues that the community is debating, that the Hispanic community is debating with great intensity, then it's absolutely an issue that all Americans should be able to participate in the discussion.
About 10 minutes left in this part of the show. Again, let me introduce one last time our guest for this hour, Adam Siegel. He is director of the Hispanic Voter Project at Johns Hopkins University, based at the university's Washington Center for the Study of American Government in Washington, D.C. They're interested in getting people to pay attention to the fact that the nation's Hispanic American voters are growing in their political importance, and that is certainly indicated by the fact that the parties and candidates and interest groups are making much greater efforts than they have in the past to reach these voters. They're spending more time trying to speak to them. They're spending more money trying to speak to them, and that's very obvious this time around in the presidential election. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You know, I think that as here in this country, as we think about the country and where it's headed and the role that immigrants and newcomers play, that these days there seems to be some fairly heated debate around the issues that you were just talking about a moment ago.
Sure.
About acculturation and assimilation. And I think that somehow people have in their minds perhaps that if you look at what the immigrant experience was let us say, before in the period before World War II, and historically what it has been, is that people had a greater tendency to assimilate. And that what we saw that at that point was it was not necessarily the people gave up their cultures and gave up their ties with their country of origin, but there was perhaps more emphasis placed on becoming American, for whatever that means.
Right.
And that in more recent years, the sort of the balance of these two things has shifted in the favor of perhaps more acculturation and a little bit less assimilation. At least I think that people, particularly people who are worried, who would say that they're worried about this, they talk about things like that. And I guess, first of all, I wonder if, you know, as much as you can do it, if you look back enough in American history, whether in fact that's true. I mean, what is it? Is it true that it used to be that somehow there was more assimilation, and that now what's happened is that more of what happens, you have to say that is more acculturation, or somehow it's not that it's things have changed, but somehow that our preoccupation with it has changed the way that we look at it.
Sure, and I think that part of that change has been influenced by the dramatic growth of this community and the demonstration that Hispanic immigrants can contribute to American society and American success, even while maintaining very, very strong identities. You know, so much so that should someone who's not familiar with the Hispanic community as a whole drive through an area in a city that they're not familiar with and see signs in a shopping center that are almost entirely bilingual, English and Spanish, someone might be confused that they're in a different country, but in reality they are in a country that is increasingly willing to is increasingly willing to accept the, I guess, that long-term, a more long-term reality. Hmm. I'll give you a perfect example of this. In about a year ago, there was this intense debate. The governor of Maryland made comments where he called multiculturalism bunk. And used a four-letter word to describe multiculturalism. And there was an overwhelming response from newspapers in the area and from communities that you wouldn't expect to have such a reaction. A number of researchers dug deep, and what they found was that the governor's family, when it immigrated to this country, was living in a part of the country that in effect mirrored the Hispanic communities of today. But it was only then a German American community where bilingualism was applauded, where storefronts had signs in both German and English, and so. There's often a misconception that things are 100% different than they were in the past, and so really what I believe is happening is that there's a more long-term willingness to not only accept but to embrace communities, bilingual communities, than there has been in the past. And so I do think that something has changed. And I think that that's because of the growing success of communities that are able to succeed, in a bilingual environment.
Just to sort of finish up and to again say something about not only the potential political impact of Hispanics now, but what it might be. I guess I'm struck by a statistic that comes out from the Pew Hispanic Center folks that many adult Latinos can't vote because they're not citizens. And in 2003, only 40% of the nation's Hispanics were eligible to vote. If given over time what we think, you know, we've seen steady increases in the percentage of the population that's Hispanic, and we expect that probably that's going to continue. And if indeed those people really get to the point where they are able to participate so that they are citizens, and then they're going on to actually register in voting. It seems that here we have a potential for a very influential block of voters in the not-too-distant future.
Oh, sure. It's happening at the municipal level across the country in lots of places. Already the Hispanic vote and Hispanic elected officials have more influence than ever before. And I think when people look back on the 2004 election, not only will they recognize a greater political influence of Hispanic voters, but I think they'll also recognize the growing success of Hispanic elected officials across the country at the local or county or even statewide level. You know, this is the first time where two Hispanic Americans are very likely to be elected to the United States Senate and to serve at the same time. I mean, that's remarkable. And the number of Hispanic Americans in Congress continues to grow. While it's too slow and not really representing the community proportionally, there are a lot of successes are happening each election cycle.
Well, we will have to leave it there because we've come to the end of the time. Mr. Siegel, I want to say thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, it was wonderful. It was a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Right. Our guest, Adam Siegel, he is the director of the Hispanic Voter Project at Johns Hopkins University. It's based at the university's Washington Center for the Study of American Government in Washington, D.C. Our program, Focus 580, made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. A little later today on the Afternoon Magazine, they'll be doing a show that they do on a regular basis they call The Law and You, a monthly discussion of legal issues. Today, a look at the issue of religious freedom. Celeste Quinn will be talking with Father Robert Drynan. He's professor of law at Georgetown University. His latest book is titled, Can God and Caesar Coexist? Balancing Religious Freedom and International Law. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. And of course, your questions and comments will be welcome. The show itself gets underway at noon with news, sports, weather, other things. Celeste Quinn is the host. In the next part of this show, we'll be looking for your questions for Tim Johnson. He is a candidate for Congress. He's a Republican who's the current incumbent in the 15th Congressional District. We try to have candidates here on the program in the run-up to elections, and it's your opportunity to have a little personal contact. Whatever issues are very important to you, you can call in and ask those questions. That's in the next hour. We'll have news from National Public Radio, but first, an update on the commodity market, so please stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-